flagged a cab to take him to Teterboro Airport. He'd think about it all the way across the Atlantic. Chapter 27. Transfer Agents. It really is a waste of time, Barbara Archer said at her seat in the conference room. F4 is dead, just her heart still beating. We've tried everything. Nothing stops Shiva, not a damn thing. Except the B-vaccine antibodies, Kilgore noted. Except them, Archer agreed. But nothing else works, does it? There was agreement around the table. They had literally tried every treatment modality known to medicine, including things merely speculated upon at CDC, USAMRID, and the Pasteur Institute in Paris. They'd even tried every antibiotic in the arsenal from penicillin to Keflex, and two new synthetics under experimentation by Merck and Horizon. The use of the antibiotics had merely been T-crossing and I-dotting, since not one of them helped viral infections. But in desperate times, people tried desperate measures, and perhaps something new and unexpected might have happened. But not with Shiva. This new and improved version of Ebola hemorrhagic fever, genetically engineered to be hardier than the naturally produced version that still haunted the Congo River Valley, was as close to 100% fatal and 100% resistant to treatment as anything known to medical science. And absent a landmark breakthrough in infectious disease treatment, nothing would help those exposed to it. Many would suffer exposure from the initial release, and the rest would get it from the A vaccine Steve Berg had developed. And through both modalities, Shiva would sweep across the world like a slow-developing storm. Inside of 6 months, the people left alive would fall into three categories. First, those who hadn't been exposed in any way. There would be few of them, since every nation on Earth would gobble up supplies of the A vaccine and inject their citizens with it, because the first Shiva victims would horrify any human with access to a television. The second group would be those rarest of people whose immune systems were sufficient to protect them from Shiva. The lab had yet to discover any such individuals, but some would inevitably be out there. Happily, most of those would probably die from the collapse of social services in the cities and towns of the world, mainly from starvation, or from the panicked lawlessness sure to accompany the plague, or from the ordinary bacterial diseases that accompanied large numbers of unburied dead. The third group would be the few thousand people in Kansas. Project Lifeboat, as they thought of it. That group would be composed of active project members, just a few hundred of them, and their families, and other selected scientists protected by Berg's B vaccine. The Kansas facility was large, isolated, and protected by large quantities of weapons, should any unwelcome visitors approach. 6 months, they thought. 27 weeks. That's what the computer projections told them. Some areas would go faster than others. The model suggested that Africa would go last of all, because they'd be the last to get the A vaccine distributed, and because of the poor infrastructure for delivering vital services. Europe would go down first, with its socialized medical care systems and pliant citizens sure to show up for their shots when summoned. Then America, then in due course the rest of the world. The whole world, just like that, Kilgore observed, looking out the windows at the New York-New Jersey border area, with its rolling hills and green deciduous trees. The great farms on the plains that ran from Canada to Texas would go fallow, though some would grow wild wheat for centuries to come. The bison would expand rapidly from their enclaves in Yellowstone and private game farms, and with them the wolves and barren ground grizzly bear, and the birds, and the coyotes, and the prairie dogs. Nature would restore her balance very quickly, the computer models told them. In less than 5 years, the entire Earth would be transformed. Yes, John, Barb Archer agreed, but we're not there yet. What do we do with the test subjects? Kilgore knew what she'd be suggesting. Archer hated clinical medicine. F4 first. It's a waste of air to keep her breathing, and we all know it. They're all in pain, and we're not learning anything except that Shiva is lethal. And we already knew that. Plus, we're going to be moving out west in a few weeks, and why keep them alive that long? We're not moving them out with us, are we? Well, no, another physician admitted. Okay, I am tired of wasting my time as a clinician for dead people. I move that we do what we have to do and be done with it. Second, agreed another scientist at the table. In favor, Kilgore asked, counting the hands. Opposed. Only two of those. The eyes have it. Okay, Barbara and I will take care of it. Today, Barb? Why not, John? Archer inquired tiredly. Kirk McLean? Agent Sullivan asked. That's right, the man said from behind the door. FBI. Sullivan held up his ID. Can we talk to you? About what? The usual alarm, the agent saw. Do we have to stand in the hall to talk? Sullivan asked reasonably. Oh, okay, sure, come in. McLean stepped back and opened the door to let them in, then led them into his living room. The TV was on, some cable movie, the agent saw. Kung Fu and guns, mostly, it appeared. I'm Tom Sullivan, and this is Frank Chatham. We're looking into the disappearance of two women, the senior agent said after sitting down. We're hoping that you might be able to help us. Sure. You mean, like, they were kidnapped or something? The man asked. Well, that is a possibility. Their names are Ann Pretlow and Mary Bannister. Some people have told us that you might have known one or both of them, Chatham said next. They watched McLean close his eyes, then look off to the window for a few seconds. From the Turtle Inn, maybe? Is that where you met them? Hey, guys, I meet a lot of girls, you know. That's a good place for it, with the music and all. Got pictures? Here. Chatham handed them across. Oh, yeah, I remember Annie. Never learned her last name, he explained. Legal secretary, isn't she? That's correct, Sullivan confirmed. How well did you know her? We danced some. Talked some, had a few drinks. But I never dated her. Ever leave the bar with her? Take a walk, anything like that? I think I walked her home once. Her apartment was just a few blocks away, right? Yeah, he remembered after a few seconds. Half a block off Columbus Avenue. I walked her home. But hey, I didn't go inside. I never did have sex with her. He appeared embarrassed. "Do you know if she had any other friends?" Chatham asked, taking interview notes. "Yeah, there was a guy she was tight with, Jim something, accountant, I think. I don't know how tight they were, but when the two of them were at the bar, they'd usually have drinks together. The other one, I remember the face, but not the name. Maybe we talked some, but I don't remember much. Hey, you know, it's a singles bar, and you meet lots of people, and sometimes you connect, but mainly you don't. Phone numbers? Not from these two. I have two from other girls I met there. Want 'em? McLean asked. Did they know Mary Bannister or Ann Pretlow? Sullivan asked. Maybe. The women connect better than the men do, you know, little cliques like checking us out. Like the guys do, but they're better organized, like, you know. There were more questions, about half an hour's worth, some repeated a few times, which McLean didn't seem to mind, as some did. Finally, they asked if they could look around the apartment. They had no legal right to do this, but oddly, even criminals often allowed it, and more than one of them had been caught because they'd had evidence out in plain view. In this case, the agents would be looking for periodicals with photographs of deviant sex practices, or even personal photographs of such behavior. But when McLean led them about, the only photos they saw were of animals and periodicals about nature and conservation. Some of them from groups the FBI deemed to be extremist, and all manner of outdoors gear. "Hiker?" Chatham asked. "Love it in the back country," McLean confirmed. "What I need is a gal who likes it too, but you don't find many of those in this town." "Guess not." Sullivan handed over his card. "If you think of anything, please call me right away. My home number's on the back. Thanks for your help." "Not sure I helped very much," the man observed. "Every little bit, as they say." "See you," Sullivan said, shaking his hand. McLean closed the door behind them and let out a long breath. How the fuck had they gotten his name and address? The questions were everything he would have expected, and he'd thought about the answers often enough. But a long time ago, he told himself. Why now? Were the cops dumb, or slow, or what? "Whole lot of nothing," Chatham said as they got to their car. "Well, maybe the women he gave us can tell us something."
"I doubt it. I talked to the second one last night at the bar."
"Go back to her. Ask her what she thinks of McLean," Sullivan suggested.
"Okay, Tom. That I can do."
"You get any vibes off the guy?"
"I didn't," Chatham said.
Sullivan shook his head.
"No, but I haven't learned to read minds yet."
Chatham nodded.
"Right."
It was time, and there was no point in delaying it. Barbara Archer unlocked the medication cabinet with her keys and took out 10 ampoules of potassium saline solution. These went into her pockets. Outside F4's treatment room, she filled a 50cc syringe, then opened the door.
"Hello." Mainly a groan from the patient, who was lying in bed and watching the wall-mounted TV listlessly.
"Hello, Mary. How are we feeling?"
Archer suddenly wondered why it was that physicians asked how we were feeling. An odd linguistic nuance, she told herself, learned in medical school probably, maybe to establish solidarity with the patient, which hardly existed in this case. One of her first summer jobs in college had been working at a dog pound. The animals had been given 7 days, and if nobody claimed them, they were euthanized. Murdered, as she thought of it, mainly with heavy doses of phenobarbital. The injection always went into the left foreleg, she remembered, and the dogs just went to sleep in 5 seconds or so. She'd always cried afterward. It had always been done on Tuesday, right before lunch, she recalled. And she'd never eaten lunch afterward. Sometimes not even supper if she'd been forced to terminate a particularly cute dog. They'd lined them up on stainless steel treatment tables, and another employee had held them still to make the murders easier. She'd always talk soothingly to the dogs, to lessen their fear, and so give them an easier death. Archer bit her lip, feeling rather like Adolf Eichmann must have. Well, should have, anyway.
"Pretty rotten," Mary Bannister replied finally.
"Well, this will help," Archer promised, pulling the syringe out and thumbing off the plastic safety cover from the needle. She took the 3 steps to the left side of the bed, reached for F4's arm, and held it still, then pushed the needle into the vein inside the elbow. Then she looked into F4's eyes and slid the plunger in. Mary's eyes went wide. The potassium solution seared the veins as it moved through them. Her right hand flew to the upper left arm, and then, a second later, to her upper chest, as the burning sensation moved rapidly to her heart. The potassium stopped the heart at once. The EKG machine next to the bed had shown fairly normal sinus rhythm, but now the moving line jumped once and went totally flat, setting off the alarm beeper. Somehow Mary's eyes remained open, for the brain has enough oxygen for up to a minute's activity, even after the heart stops delivering blood. There was shock there. F4 couldn't speak, couldn't object, because her breathing had stopped along with her heart. But she looked straight into Archer's eyes. Rather as the dog had done, the doctor thought, though the dog's eyes had never seemed to accuse her, as these two did. Archer returned the look. No emotion at all in her face, unlike her time at the pound. Then, in less than a minute, F4's eyes closed, and then she was dead. One down, 9 more to go, before Dr. Archer could go to her car and drive home. She hoped her VCR had worked properly. She'd wanted to tape the Discovery Channel's show on the wolves in Yellowstone, but figuring the damned machine out sometimes drove her crazy. 30 minutes later, the bodies were wrapped in plastic and wheeled to the incinerator. It was a special model designed for medical applications, the destruction of disposable biological material such as fetuses or amputated limbs. Fueled by natural gas, it reached an extremely high temperature, even destroying tooth fillings, and converted all to an ash so fine that prevailing winds lifted it into the stratosphere, and then carried it out to sea. The treatment rooms would be scrubbed down so that there would be no lingering Shiva presence. And for the first time in months, the facility would have no virus strands actively looking for hosts to feed upon and kill. The project members would be pleased by that, Archer thought on her drive home. Shiva was a useful tool for their objective, but sufficiently creepy that they'd all be glad when it was gone. Popoff managed 5 hours of sleep on the trip across, and was awakened when the flight attendant shook his shoulder 20 minutes out of Shannon. The former seaplane facility where Pan American's Boeing-made Clippers had landed before flying on to Southampton, and where the airline had invented Irish coffee to help the passengers wake up, was on the west coast of Ireland, surrounded by farms and green wetlands that seemed to glisten in the light of dawn. Popoff washed up in the lavatory and retook his seat for the arrival. The touchdown was smooth and the rollout brief as the aircraft approached the General Aviation Terminal, where a few other business jets sat, similar to the G-5 that Horizon Corporation had chartered for him. Barely had it stopped when a dingy official car approached the aircraft, and a man in uniform got out to jump up the stairs. The pilot waved the man to the back. "Welcome to Shannon, sir," the immigration official said. "May I see your passport, please?" "Here." Popoff handed it across. The bureaucrat thumbed through it. "Ah, you've been here recently. The purpose of your trip, sir?" "Business. Pharmaceuticals," the Russian added, in case the immigration official wanted to open his bags. "Mm-hmm," the man responded, without a shred of interest. He stamped the passport and handed it back. "Anything to declare?" "Not really." "Very well. Have a pleasant time, sir." The smile was as mechanical as his movement forward. Then he left to go down the steps to his car. Popoff didn't so much sigh in relief as grumble at his tension, which had clearly been wasted. Who would charter such an aircraft for $100,000 to smuggle drugs, after all? Something else to learn about capitalism, Dmitri Arkadyevich told himself. If you had enough money to travel like a prince, then you couldn't be outside the law. Amazing, he thought. He put on his overcoat and walked out of the aircraft, where a black Jaguar was waiting, his bags already loaded into the boot. "Mr. Saroff?" the driver asked, holding the door open. There was enough noise out here that he didn't have to worry about being overheard. "That's right. Off to see Sean?" "Yes, sir." Popoff nodded and got into the back. A minute later, they were heading off the airport grounds. The country roads were like those in England, narrower than those in America, and he was still driving on the wrong side of the road. How strange, Popoff thought. If the Irish didn't like the English, then why did they emulate their driving patterns? The ride took half an hour and ended in a farmhouse well off the main roads. Two cars were there and a van, with one man standing outside to keep watch. Popoff recognized him. It was Roddy Sands, the cautious one of this unit. Dmitri got out and looked at him without shaking hands. He took the black, drug-filled suitcase from the boot and walked in.
"Good morning, Yosef," Grady said in greeting. "How was your flight?"
"Comfortable." Popoff handed the bag over.
"This is what you requested, Sean."
The tone of voice was clear in its meaning. Grady looked his guest in the eye, a little embarrassment on his face.
"I don't like it either, but one must have money to support operations, and this is a means of getting it."
The 10 pounds of cocaine had a variable value. It had cost Horizon Corporation a mere $25,000, having bought it on the market that was open to drug companies. Diluted on the street, it would be worth 500 times that. Such was another aspect of capitalism, Popoff thought, dismissing it now that the transfer had been made. Then he handed over a slip of paper.
"That is the account number and activation code for the secure account in Switzerland. You can only make withdrawals on Monday and Wednesday as an added security measure. The account has in it $6 million of United States currency. The amount in the account can be checked at any time," Popoff told him.
"A pleasure to do business with you, as always, Joe," Sean said, allowing himself a rare smile. He'd never had so much as a tenth of that much money under his control, for all his 20-plus years as a professional revolutionary. Well, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought they weren't businessmen, were they?
"When will you move?"
"Very soon. We've checked out the objective, and our plan is a thing of beauty, my friend. We will sting them, Yosef Andreyevich," Grady promised. "We will hurt them badly."
"I will need to know when, exactly. There are things I must do as well," Popoff told him.
That stopped him, Dmitri saw. The issue here was operational security. An outsider wanted to know things that only insiders should have knowledge of. Two sets of eyes stared at each other for a few seconds. But the Irishman relented. Once he verified that the money was in place, then his trust in the Russian was confirmed. And delivery of the 10 pounds of white powder was proof of the fact in and of itself, assuming that he wasn't arrested by the Garda later this day. But Popoff wasn't that sort, was he?
"The day after tomorrow. The operation will commence at 1 in the afternoon exactly."
"So soon?"
Grady was pleased that the Russian had underestimated him.
"Why delay? We have everything we need now that the money is in place."
"As you say, Sean. Do you require anything else of me?"
"No."
"Then I will be off, with your permission."
This time they shook hands.
"Daniel will drive you."
"To Dublin?"
"Correct. The airport there."
"Tell him, and he will take you."
"Thank you, Sean.
And good luck."
"Perhaps we will meet afterwards," Dmitri added.
"I would like that."
Popoff gave him a last look, sure that it would be the last, despite what he'd just said. Grady's eyes were animated now, thinking about a revolutionary demonstration that would be the capstone of his career. There was a cruelty there that Popoff had not noted before. Like Ferkner and Dortmund, this was a predatory animal rather than a human being, and as much experience as he'd had with such people, Popoff found himself troubled by it. He was supposed to be skilled at reading minds, but in this one he saw only emptiness, only the absence of human feelings, replaced by ideology that led him... where?
Did Grady know?
Probably not. He thought himself on the path to some radiant future,
the term most favored by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. But the light that beckoned him was far more distant than he realized, and its bright glow hid the holes in the road immediately before him. And truly, Popov thought on, were he ever to achieve that which he wanted, then he'd be a disaster as a ruler of men, like those he resembled, Stalin, Mao, and the rest, so divorced from the common man's outlook as to be an alien, for whom life and death were mere tools to achieve his vision, not something of humanity at all. Of all the things Karl Marx had given the world, surely that outlook was the worst. Sean Grady had replaced his humanity and emotions with a geometrically precise model of what the world should be. And he was too wedded to that vision to take note of the fact that it had failed wherever it had been tried. His pursuit was one after a chimera, a creature not real, never quite within reach, but drawing him onward to his own destruction, and as many others as he might kill first. And his eyes sparkled now in his enthusiasm for the chase. His ideological soundness denied him the ability to see the world as it really was, as even the Russians had come to see, finally, after 70 years of following the same chimera. Sparkling eyes serving a blind master. How strange, the Russian thought, turning to leave. Okay, Peter, you have the duty, Chavez told his Team One counterpart. As of now, Team One was the go team, and Team Two was on standby, stand down, and back into the more intensive training regimen. As you say, Ding, Covington replied. But nothing seems to be happening anywhere. The intelligence that had been passed on to them from the various national agencies was actually rather encouraging. Informants who'd chatted with known or suspected terrorists, mostly the latter since the more active ones would have been arrested, reported back that the World Park incident had chilled the atmosphere considerably, especially since the French had finally published the names and photos of the known terrorists who'd been killed in Spain. And one of them, it had turned out, had been a revered and respected former member of Action Directe, with 6 known murders to his credit, and something of a reputation as an expert operator. His public destruction had rumbled through the community, along with greatly increased respect for the Spanish police, which was basking institutionally in the glow of Rainbow's deeds, to the great discomfort of Basque terrorists, who, Spanish sources reported, were also somewhat chastened by the loss of some of their most respected members. If this was true, Bill Tawney's summary document suggested, then Rainbow was indeed having the effect that had been hoped for when it had been formed. Maybe this meant that they wouldn't have to move into the field and kill people as frequently to prove their mettle. But there was still nothing to suggest why there had been 3 such incidents so close in time, or who, if anyone, might have instigated them. The British Secret Intelligence Service's analysis section called it random, pointing out that Switzerland, Germany, and Spain were different countries, and that it was unlikely that anyone had contacts in the underground groups in all 3 of them. 2 of them, perhaps, but not all 3. It also suggested that contacts be made with former East Bloc intelligence services, to check out what was happening with certain retired members. It might even be worth buying their information for the going price, which was rather high now that the former intelligence officers had to make a real living in the real world, but not as high as the cost of an incident in which people got hurt. Tawney had highlighted that when he passed it on to John Clark, and the latter had discussed it with Langley again, only to be rebuffed again, which had Rainbow Six grumbling all week about the remuffs at CIA headquarters. Tawney thought about suggesting it to the London headquarters of 6 on his own hook, but without the positive endorsement of CIA, it would have been wasted effort. On the other hand, Rainbow did seem to be working. Even Clark admitted that, unhappy though he continued to be, he was a suit working behind a desk and sending younger men off to do the exciting stuff.
For much of his career as an intelligence officer, John had grumbled at oversight from above. Now that he was doing it, he thought that maybe he understood it a little better. Being in command might be rewarding, but it could never be much fun for someone who'd been out in the weeds, dodging the fire and involved in the things that happened out at the sharp end. The idea that he knew how it was done and could therefore tell people how to do it was as unpopular a stance for him to take as it had been for him to accept, as recently as 5 years earlier. Life was a trap, Clark told himself, and the only way out of the trap wasn't much fun either. So he donned his suit coat every morning and grumbled at the effect age had on his life, just like every other man of his age did across the planet. Where had his youth gone? How had he lost it? Popoff arrived at Dublin Airport before lunch. There he purchased a ticket to Gatwick for the hour's flight back to England. He found himself missing the G5 business jet. A very convenient way to travel, liberating from the bustle of the airports. It rode every bit as well as a jumbo jet. But he'd never have enough money to permit him to indulge himself that much. And so he struck the thought from his mind. He'd have to settle for mere first-class travel, the Russian grumbled to himself, sipping some wine as the 737 climbed to cruising altitude. Now again he had some thinking to do, and he'd found that the solitary time in the first-class cabin of an aircraft helped. Did he want Grady to succeed? More to the point, did his employer want Grady to succeed? It hadn't seemed so for Bern and Vienna, but was this a different matter? Maybe Henriksen thought so. He'd given Popoff that impression in their discussions. Was there a difference? If so, what was it? Henriksen was former FBI. Perhaps that explained it. Like Popoff, he wouldn't court failure in anything. Or did he really want this Rainbow Group damaged to the point that it couldn't what? Interfere with some operation? Again the brick wall, and again Popoff struck his head against it. He'd started 2 terrorist operations, and the only purpose for them, he could discern, was to raise the international consciousness about terrorism. Henriksen had an international consulting company in that area, and Henriksen wanted the consciousness raised so that he could win contracts. But on the surface it seemed an expensive and inefficient way of doing it, Popoff reflected. Certainly the money to be gained from the contracts, one, would be less than the money Popoff had already expended, or pocketed. And again he reminded himself that the money had come from John Breitling and his Horizon Corporation. Perhaps from Breitling himself. Not Henriksen's Global Security, Inc. So the 2 companies were related in their objectives, but not in their financial support. Therefore, Popoff thought, sipping his French Chablis, the operation is entirely Breitling's doing, with Henriksen as a support service, providing expertise and advice. But one objective was to get Henriksen the consulting contract for the Sydney Olympics, to start in only a few weeks. That had been very important to both Breitling and Henriksen. Therefore, Henriksen was doing something of great importance to Breitling, doubtless in support of the latter's goal, whatever the hell that was. But what did Breitling and his company do? Horizon Corporation and all of its numerous international subsidiaries were in the business of medical research. The company manufactured medicines, and spent a huge amount of money every year to invent new ones. It was a world leader in the field of medical research. It had Nobel Prize winners working in its labs, and, as internet research had determined, it was working in some very exciting areas of potential medical advancement. Popoff shook his head again. What did genetic engineering and pharmaceutical manufacturing have to do with terrorism? The light bulb that went off over the Irish Sea reminded him that only a relatively few months before, America had been attacked with biological warfare. It had killed about 5,000 people, and incurred the lethal wrath of the United States and her president. The dossier he'd been given said that the chief of this Rainbow Group, Clark,
and his son-in-law, Chavez, had played a quiet but very dramatic role in concluding that bloody little war. Bio-war, Popov thought. It had given the entire world a reason to shudder. In the event, it had proven to be an ineffective weapon of statecraft, especially since America had reacted with her customary speed and furious effectiveness on the battlefields of Saudi Arabia. As a result, no nation-state today dared even to contemplate an attack on America. Its armed forces strode the world like a frontier sheriff in a Western movie, respected and, more to the point, feared for their lethal capabilities. Popov finished his wine and fingered the empty glass in his hand as he looked down at the approaching green coastline of England. Bio-war. It had made the whole world shiver in fear and disgust. Horizon Corporation was deeply into cutting-edge research in medical science, so surely Breitling's business could well be involved with biological warfare research. But to what possible end? Besides, it was a mere corporation, not a nation-state. It had no foreign policy. It had nothing to gain from warlike activities. Corporations didn't make war, except, perhaps, on other corporations. They might try to steal trade secrets, but actually shed blood? Of course not. Again, Popov told himself, he had merely found a blank, hard wall to smash his head against.
Okay, Sergeant Major Dick Voss told them. First of all, the sound quality of these digital radios is so good that you can recognize voices just like a regular conversation in a living room. Second, the radios are coded, so that if you have two different teams operating in the field, one team comes in the left ear, and the other team comes in the right ear. That's to keep the commander from getting too confused, he explained, to the amusement of the Australian NCOs. This gives you more positive control of your operations, and it keeps everybody informed on what's going on. The more you people know, the more effective you will be in the field. You can adjust volume on this dial here. He showed them the knob on the microphone route.
What's the range? A senior Aussie NCO asked.
Up to 10 miles, or 15,000 meters. A little longer if you have line of sight. After that, it breaks up some. The batteries are rechargeable, and every set comes with two spares. The batteries will hold their charge for about 6 months in the spare holders you have, but we recommend recharging them every week. No big deal, the charger comes with every set. And it has a universal plug set. It'll fit into a wall socket here or any place else in the world. You just play with a little fucker until you get the right plug pattern here, he demonstrated. Most of the people in the room looked at theirs for a few seconds.
Okay, people, let's put them on and try them out. Power on-off switch is here.
15 kilometers, eh? Malloy asked.
Right, Noonan said. This way you can listen to what we're doing on the ground, instead of waiting to be told. It fits inside your aircraft headset and shouldn't interfere much with what you need to get over your intercom. This little switch can be attached, and the control button goes down your sleeve into your hand so you can flip it on or off. It also has a listen-only mode. That's the third position here.
Slick, Sergeant Nance observed. Be nice to know what's happening on the ground.
Damn right. If you ground pounders need an evac, I'll be halfway in before you make the call.
I like it, Colonel Malloy noted. I guess we'll keep it, Tim.
It's still experimental. E-Systems says there may be a few bugs in it, but nobody's found them yet. The encryption system is state-of-the-art 128-bit continuous synchronized off the master set, but hierarchized so that if a set goes down, another automatically takes that function over. The boys and girls at Fort Meade can probably crack it, but only 12 hours after you use it.
Any problem with being inside an aircraft? Interference with any of the onboard systems? Lieutenant Harrison asked.
Not that we know of. It's been tested on Nighthawks and Stalkers at Fort Bragg. No problems discovered.
Let's check that one out, Malloy said at once. He'd learned not to trust electronics, and besides, it was a perfectly good excuse to take their Nighthawk off the ground.
Sergeant Nance, head out to the bird.
You bet, Colonel. The sergeant stood and moved toward the door.
Tim, you stay here. We'll try it inside and outside and get a range check, too.
30 minutes later, the Nighthawk was circling around Hereford.
How's this, Noonan?
Loud and clear, Bear.
Okay, good. We're about, 11 clicks out, and you are coming through like Rush Limbaugh across the street. These digital radios work nice, don't they?
Yep.
Noonan got in his car and confirmed that the metal cage around him had no effect on performance. It turned out that the radios continued to work at over 18 kilometers, or 11 miles, which wasn't bad, they thought, for something with a battery the size of 2 quarters and an antenna half again the length of a toothpick. This'll make your long rope deployments go smoother, Bear.
How so, Noonan?
Well, the guys on the end of the rope will be able to tell you when you're a little high or low.
Noonan, came the irate reply, what do you think depth perception is for?
Roger that, Bear, the FBI agent laughed.
Chapter 28 Broad Daylight. The money made it far easier. Instead of stealing trucks, they could buy them with cashier's checks drawn from an account set up by a person with false identification papers, who'd also been wearing a disguise at the time. The trucks were large, Swedish-made Volvo commercial vehicles, straight or non-articulated trucks with canvas covers over the load area that proclaimed the names of non-existent businesses. The trucks came across the Irish Sea to Liverpool on commercial ferries, their interiors laden with cardboard cartons for refrigerators, and passed through British customs with no trouble. And from there it was just a matter of driving within the legal limit on the motorways. The trucks traveled in close formation through the West Country and arrived near Hereford just before dusk. There, at a prearranged point, they all parked. The drivers dismounted at the local equivalent of a truck stop and headed for a pub. Sean Grady and Roddy Sands had flown in the same day. They'd passed through customs immigration control at Gatwick with false papers that had stood the test of time on numerous previous occasions, and again proved to their satisfaction that British immigration officers were blind as well as deaf and dumb. Both of them rented cars with false credit cards and drove west to Hereford, also along pre-planned routes, and arrived at the same pub soon before the arriving trucks.
"Any problems?" Grady asked the Berry twins.
"None," Sam replied, accompanied by a nod from Peter. As always, the members of his unit made a show of sang-froid, despite the pre-mission jitters they all had to have. Soon everyone was there, and two groups, one of 7 and one of 8, sat in booths, sipping their Guinness and chatting quietly, their presence not a matter of interest to pub regulars.
"They work pretty good," Malloy told Noonan, over a pint in the club.
"E-systems, eh?"
"Pretty good outfit. We used a lot of their hardware at HRT.
The Marine nodded.
"Yeah, same thing in Special Operations Command. But I still prefer things with control wires and cables."
"Well, yeah, Colonel, sir, but kind of hard to do 2 paper cups and string out of a chopper, ain't it?"
"I ain't that backward, Tim."
But it was good enough for a grin.
"And I ain't never needed help doing a long-wire deployment."
"You are pretty good at it." Noonan sipped at his beer.
"How long you been flying choppers?"
20 years.
21 come next October.
"You know, it's the last real flying left. The new fast movers hell computers take a vote on whether they like what you're doing before they decide to do it for you. I play with computers, games, and email and such, but damned if I'll ever let them fly for me."
It was an empty boast, or nearly so, Noonan thought. Sooner or later that form of progress would come to rotary wing aircraft too, and the drivers would bitch, but then they'd accept it as they had to and move on, and probably be safer and more effective as a result.
"Waiting for a letter from my detailer right now," the colonel added.
"Oh, what for?"
"I'm in the running for CO of VMH-1.
"Flying the president around?"
Malloy nodded. Hank Goodman's got the job now, but he made star, and so they're moving him up to something else. And somebody, I guess, heard that I'm pretty good with a stick.
Not too shabby, Noonan said.
Boring, though. Straight and level all the time. No fun stuff, the Marine allowed, with a show of false distaste. Flying in VMH-1 was an honor for a captain, and command of it was the Corps' way of showing confidence in his abilities. I ought to know in another 2 weeks. Be nice to see some Redskins games in person again.
What's up for tomorrow?
Right before lunch, practice low-level insertion, paperwork in the afternoon. I have to do a ton of it for the Air Force. Well, they own the damned aircraft, and they are nice about maintaining it and giving me a good flight crew. I bet airliner pilots don't have to do this, though. Those lucky bastards just had to fly, though their brand of flying was about as exciting as a paint-drying race, or maybe a grass-growing marathon. Chavez hadn't yet gotten used to British humor, and as a result, the series television on the local stations mainly bored him. He did have cable service, however, and that included the History Channel, which had become his favorite, if not Patsy's. Just one ding, she told him. Now that she was close to delivery time, she wanted her husband sober at all times, and that meant only one beer per night. Yes, honey. It was so easy for women to push men around, Domingo thought, looking at the nearly empty glass and feeling like another. It was great to sip beer in the club and discuss business matters in a comfortable, informal setting, and generally bond with his people. But right now he was going no farther than 50 feet from his wife, except when he had to, and she had his beeper number when they were apart. The baby had dropped, whatever that meant. Well, he knew it meant that delivery was imminent, but not what dropped signified. And now it meant that he could only have one beer per night, though he could be stone sober with three, maybe even four. They sat in side-by-side easy chairs. Ding was trying both to watch TV and read intelligence documents. It was something he seemed able to do, to the amazed annoyance of his wife, who was reading a medical journal and making some marginal notes on the glossy paper. It wasn't terribly different at the Clark home, though here a movie cassette was tucked into the VCR and was playing away. "Anything new at the office?" Sandy asked. At the office, John thought. She hadn't said that when he'd come back from out in the field. No, then it had been, "Are you okay?" Always asked with a tinge of concern, because, though he'd never—well, almost never—told her about the things he did in the field, Sandy knew that it was a little different from sitting at a desk. So this was just one more confirmation that he was a rear-echelon motherfucker. Remoff. "Thanks, honey," he thought. "No, not really," he said. "How about the hospital?" "A car accident right after lunch. Nothing major." "How's Patsy doing?" "She'll be a pretty good doc when she learns to relax a little more. But, well, I've been doing ER for 20-some years, right? She knows more than I do in the theoretical area, but she needs to learn the practical side a little better. But, you know, she's coming along pretty well." "Ever think you might have been a doc?" her husband asked. "I suppose I could have, but wasn't the right time back then, was it?" "How about the baby?" That made Sandy smile. "Just like I was. Impatient. You get to that point and you just want it to happen and be done with it." "Any worries?" "No, Dr. Reynolds is pretty good and Patsy is doing just fine. I'm just not sure I'm ready to be a grandma yet," Sandy added with a laugh. "I know what you mean, babe. Any time, eh?" "The baby dropped yesterday. That means he's pretty ready." "He?" John asked. "That's what everybody seems to think, but we'll find out when it pops out." John grumbled. Domingo had insisted that it had to be a son, handsome as his father was. "And bilingual, jefe," he'd always added with that sly Latino grin.
Well, he could have gotten worse as a son-in-law. Ding was smart, about the fastest learner he'd ever stumbled across. Having risen from young staff sergeant, 11 Bravo Light Infantryman, U.S. Army, to a respected field intelligence officer in CIA, with a master's degree from George Mason University. And now he occasionally mused about going another 2 years for his Ph.D. Maybe from Oxford, Ding had speculated earlier in the week, if he could arrange the off time to make it possible. Wouldn't that be a kick in the ass? An East L.A. Chicano with a hood from Oxford University. He might end up DCI someday, and then he would really be intolerable. John chuckled, sipped his Guinness, and returned his attention to the television. Popoff told himself that he had to watch. He was in London again, checked into a medium-class hotel made from a bunch of row houses strung together and renovated. This one he had to see. It would be a first for a terrorist operation. They had a real plan, albeit suggested by Bill Henriksen, but Grady had jumped on the idea, and it certainly seemed a tactically sound concept, as long as they knew when to end it and run away. In any case, Dimitri wanted to see it happen, the better to know if he could then call the bank and recode the money into his own account and then disappear from the face of the earth whenever he wished. It hadn't occurred to Grady that there were at least two people who could access the funds transferred. Perhaps Sean was a trusting soul, Popoff thought, odd as that proposition sounded. He'd accepted the contract from his former KGB friend readily, and though he'd posed two major tests, the money and the cocaine, once they'd been delivered, he'd stood right up to take the action promised. That was remarkable, now that Popoff allowed himself to think about it. But he'd take his rented Jaguar saloon car to go and watch. It ought not to be overly hard, he thought, nor overly dangerous if he did it right. With that thought, he tossed off his last Stolichnaya of the night and flipped off the light. They woke up at the same time that morning, Domingo and Patricia in one home, and John and Sandra in another. Opened their eyes at 5:30 when their alarms went off, and both couples adjusted their routine to the schedule of the day. The women had to be at the local hospital at 6:45 for the beginning of their 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. day shift in the emergency room. And so, in both homes, the women folk got the bathroom first, while the men padded into the kitchen to feed the coffee machine and flip it on, then collect the morning papers from the front step, and turn the radios on to the BBC for the morning news. 20 minutes later, the bathrooms and newspapers were exchanged, and 15 minutes after that, the two couples sat down in the kitchen for breakfasts. Though in Domingo's case, just a second cup of coffee, as he customarily breakfasted with his people after morning PT. In the Clark home, Sandy was experimenting with fried tomatoes, a local delicacy that she was trying to learn, but which her husband utterly rejected on principle as an American citizen. By 6:20 it was time for the women to dress in their respective uniforms, and for the men to do the same. And soon thereafter all left their homes to begin their different daily activities. Clark didn't work out with the teams. He was, he'd finally admitted to himself, too old to sustain the full grind. But he showed up at roughly the same place and did roughly the same daily exercise. It wasn't very different from his time as a SEAL, though without the lengthy swim. There was a pool here, but it wasn't large enough to suit him. Instead, he ran for 3 miles. The teams did 5, though. And, he admitted, shamefully, to himself, at a faster pace. For a man of his years, John Clark knew himself to be in superb physical shape. But keeping himself there got harder every day, and the next major milestone on his personal road to death had the number 60 on it. It seemed so very odd that he was no longer the young piss-and-vinegar guy he'd been when he'd married Sandy. It seemed as if someone had robbed him of something, but if it had happened, he'd never noticed it. It was just that one day he'd looked around and found himself different from what he'd thought himself to be,
Not an agreeable surprise at all, he told himself, finishing his 3 miles, sweating over sore legs and needing his second shower of the day. On the walk to headquarters, he saw Alistair Stanley setting out for his own morning exercise routine. Al was younger than he by 5 years and probably still had the illusion of youth. They'd become good friends. Stanley had the instincts, especially for intelligence information, and was an effective field operator in his oddly laid-back British way. Like a spider hole, John thought. Stanley didn't appear to be much of anything until you looked at his eyes. And even then you had to know what to look for. Good-looking, rakish sort, blonde hair still, and a toothy smile. But like John, he'd killed in the field. And, like John, he didn't have nightmares about it. In truth, he had better instincts as a commander than Clark did, the latter admitted to himself, but only to himself. Both men were still as competitive as they'd been in their 20s, and neither gave praise away for free. Finished with his shower, Clark walked to his office, sat down at his desk, and went over the morning paperwork, cursing it quietly for the time it required, and all the thought that had to go into such wasteful items as budgeting. Right in his desk drawer was his Beretta 45, proof that he wasn't just one more civil servant. But today he wouldn't have time to walk over to the range to practice the martial skills that had made him the commander of Rainbow, a position that ironically denied him the ability to prove he belonged. Mrs. Forgate arrived just after 8, looked into her boss's office, and saw the frown she always saw when he was doing administrative work, as opposed to going over intelligence information or operational matters, which at least he appeared to find interesting. She came in to start his coffee machine, got the usual morning greeting grunt, then returned to her desk, and checked the secure fax machine for anything that might have to go to the boss at once. There was nothing. Another day had started at Hereford. Grady and his people were awake as well. They went through their breakfast routine of tea and eggs and bacon and toast, for the typical Irish breakfast was little different from the English. In fact, the countries were little different in any of their fundamental habits, a fact Grady and his people did not reflect upon. Both were polite societies, and extremely hospitable to visitors. Citizens in both countries smiled at one another, worked fairly hard at their jobs, largely watched the same TV, read the same sports pages, and played mainly the same sports, which in both countries were true national passions, and drank similar quantities of similar beers in pubs that could have easily been in one nation as another, down to the painted signs and names that identified them. But they attended different churches, and had different accents, seemingly so similar to outsiders, that sounded totally different to each of them. An ear for such things remained an important part of daily life, but global television was changing that slowly. A visitor from 50 years earlier would have noted the many Americanisms that had crept into the common language. But the process had been so gradual that those living through it took little note of the fact. It was a situation common to countries with revolutionary movements. The differences were small to outside observers, but all the more magnified to those who advocated change, to the point that Grady and his people saw English similarities merely as camouflage that made their operations convenient, not as commonalities that might have drawn their nations closer. People with whom they might have shared a pint and a discussion of a particularly good football match were as alien to them as men from Mars, and therefore easy to kill. They were things, not mates, and as crazy as that might have appeared to an objective third party, it was sufficiently inculcated into them that they took no more note of it than they did of the air on this clear blue morning, as they moved to their trucks and cars preparing for the day's mission. At 10:30 a.m., Chavez and his team moved to the indoor range for marksmanship practice. Dave Woods was there, and had set the boxes of ammunition in the proper places for the Team 2 members. As before, Chavez decided to work on his pistol rather than the easier-to-use MP-10, which anyone with two functioning eyes and one working trigger finger